You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Well, Lionel.
Well, Richard, what?
Well, Francois.
Well.
Well, what a stage that was at the Giro. We've again had a double header today, Giro and Vuelta action. But I think the Giro edged it today for drama and excitement and intrigue, didn't it? Well, I know you're looking skeptical.
No, not
about
at all.
That.
I mean, it's not even close as far as I'm concerned. No. I mean, the Giro is a barnstormer, wasn't it? The world jacket putting on championships really ignited on the Stelvio.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of echoes what we were saying last night about the Giro, that the great fascination in it is not knowing who was going to win. And I'm not sure, we're maybe a bit closer to that tonight, but that was really what underpinned, I think, the drama today. It was, you know, the race was sort of being turned on its head as we watched it. João Almeida finally cracked. Just so much intrigue, so much debate. And we'll hear from Joe Dombrowski again, who's got great insight into putting on a rain jacket, in fact.
Yeah, and unlike what you just said, Richard, the race is tighter than ever. I mean, you got three guys within, what, 15 seconds? We're you know, nearing the end of the Giro, and we have no idea whatsoever who is going to win that, and it's even tighter than it was before that stage. So yeah.
Well, maybe at the end of our Giro discussion, we'll each pick the rider who we think is most likely to win.
I'm not changing my. I made some sort of a gamble yesterday. Naming an Ineos Grenadier. I didn't name him, but
oh, you did. Yeah.
So I'm sticking to my.
Well, there's only one really in the running. Lionel, can you give us the headlines from a dramatic day?
Yes, Richard. Well, first of all, the Giro Stage 18 from Pinzolo to Laghi di Cancano, 207 kilometers over the Stelvio, the beautiful, mythical, legendary Stelvio. Fantastic camera work, I have to say, today. The way the way the pictures unfolded and told the story was fantastic. We had lots of shots looking down through the hairpins. We had helicopter shots giving us the picture of where all the riders were, and it was absolutely absorbing, wasn't it? As you say, João Almeida finally cracked quite early on the Stelvio climb, and was he had Fausto Masnada of Quickstep, his teammate, to help him, but the help was slightly sporadic, shall we say. We'll talk about that a bit.
Yeah, we will talk about that, because it was quite odd. And apparently Fausto Masnada is not very popular with Portuguese cycling Twitter tonight, according to our colleague Andy McGrath.
Well, that doesn't surprise me, but it was a day for debate about team tactics, wasn't it? Because Wilco Kelderman cracked, and Rowan Dennis was doing a fantastic job for Ineos Grenadiers. He had Theo Gegenhardt on his wheel. Jai Hindley of Sunweb had Wilco Kelderman for company, but then suddenly Kelderman was not there anymore, and well, we'll talk about whether or not Sunweb played it right. Then, as I said, there was a drama of both Sunweb riders struggling to put on their warm jackets going over the top of the Stelvio. And on the final climb, it was Hindley and Gegenhardt together, and Hindley took the stage win. And as you say, Francois, there's only 15 seconds between the top three. Kelderman rode, I thought, very well, a lonely old 50 kilometres for him, but he's moved into the pink jersey. He's 12 seconds ahead of his teammate Jai Hindley. Theo Gegenhardt is at 15 seconds, but so much more to discuss from the Giro, and we'll do that in the first half of the podcast. It may be a slightly lopsided podcast. Perhaps first half will be about 65 or 70% of the podcast. I don't know. And
it'd be like a seesaw with you on one end, Lionel, and your baby daughter on the other.
I thought you were going to say you on the other side. Then it'd be very much 40-60, wouldn't it? Anyway,
but it would actually.
Anyway, yeah. Over to the Vuelta, a cracking stage again, and a cheeky uphill finish. The stage was won by Ireland's Dan Martin, ahead of Primoz Roglic and Richard Carapaz. The sight of the three leaders' jerseys coming over the line, 1, 2 and 3. Roglic is still in the overall lead by 5 seconds from Dan Martin, Carapaz at 13 seconds. A lot of the original GC contenders still up there, but the race goes on without Thibaut Pinot. He did not start this morning, so the Vuelta's over for Pinot. We'll talk about the Vuelta in part two.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker, flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, iWalka. They've been supporting us since March, and we're very grateful to them. They're allowing us to bring you The Grandest Tour, our nightly podcast throughout the Giro and the Vuelta a España. 5 weeks of daily podcasts. A lot for you to listen to. Thanks, everybody who is tuning in. And if you'd like to know a little bit more about iWalka and how they might be able to help you, if you have a small business, go to iwalka.co.uk. That's iwoca.co.uk. Now, chaps, I don't really know where to start with today's stage of the Giro. There's a lot to talk about, but in case it gets missed, I want to just say a little thing about Joao Almeida, who has been, well, he's out the pink jersey now, and what a great ride from him. His first year as a pro, let's not forget. A young rider. You know, he lost the pink jersey today, but he still rode exceptionally well. He was seventh on the stage, 4:51 back. He is now in fifth overall with, I would think, a decent chance of holding that. A fantastic performance from him. And the way that he fought today, even after being dropped, and as you said, Lionel, having sort of erratic help from Masnada, who appeared at one point to be shouting at him and quite angry at him. A great ride from Almeida, and he has well and truly arrived, I think, and it'll be fascinating to watch his progress. But the real story or stories were happening up the road, weren't they, today? I have to say, Rob Hatch did a great job of calling the race today, and one of his memorable lines was, "Goodbye, granddads," as Jakob Fuglsang and Vincenzo Nibali slipped out. And I think we were still in the back of our minds, certainly the back of my mind, was the idea that Nibali might just produce something today. It never looked likely, and it really was the young guns, but Rohan Dennis as well. I mean, Ineos put two riders, Filippo Ganna and Ben Swift, in the big breakaway. Joe Dombrowski was there as well. We'll hear from him a bit later on. They clearly had a plan today, but it was Rohan Dennis. You know, I don't think anybody saw him shredding the race to pieces up the Stelvio. But he did. Fantastic ride. Got rid of Kelderman, as you said. And then Jai Hindley was there. He was the stone in the shoe for Ineos Grenadiers today. They couldn't shake him and never looked like shaking him. But the question was, should Jai Hindley have waited for Wilco Kelderman? Because Kelderman was ahead of him, well ahead of him on GC. He was riding into the pink jersey. You know, on paper, has a better chance of winning the race. He's in the pink jersey now. Should Jai Hindley have waited for Wilco Kelderman? That is the question.
Well, I think it was you used the stone in the shoe, you know, metaphor or image. I think Hindley was a stone in the shoe of Wilco Kelderman as well, and probably a stone in the shoe of Luke Roberts, who was in the car trying to decide on the tactics for Sunweb. For me, it's obvious he shouldn't have waited for Wilco Kelderman, because we saw today. I mean, Kelderman had a very, very hard moment at the end of the Stelvio. You could even wonder, because he was much better in the final climb, whether he didn't, you know, had a little fringale, as we say in French, whether he didn't have a, but. Obviously, he was going much better in the final climb. But in my opinion, not only should not Hindley have waited for Kelderman. But I think that in the final climb, he was probably, you know, told to hold back a little bit and not attack, because he could have, you know, spurred Gegenhardt into reaction. But given the impression he gave today and the days before in the mountain, my personal impression is that Hindley could really have done more than he did, which is win the stage and take the jersey. Because if you look at the results of these, only 12 seconds behind Kelderman and Eddie, you know, they kind of watch each other, Gegenhardt and Hindley, in the final climb. And my impression was that Hindley could really have attacked, and they could have definitely, you know, killed Kelderman Giro chances. My impression is that what Sunweb had at the back of their mind is the final TT, in which normally Kelderman is better than Hindley, and they didn't want to sacrifice, you know, their leader to Hindley's you know, chances because of that final TT. But for me, by far Hindley was the stronger guy today, and he could have, in my opinion, made much more damage than he did.
Lionel, where do you stand on this great debate?
Well, it seems to me fairly simple. Sunweb did the right thing. At the moment that Kelderman was struggling, it was two Sunweb and two Ineos Grenadiers. And for Sunweb to say to Hindley, they would have to have said it immediately. They would have to have made that decision pretty much as soon as Kelderman was kind of, you know, 50 metres off the back. That was the point at which the decision had to be made. And at that stage, there was still a long way to go to the top of the Stelvio. It could have gone either way for Kelderman. As it was, he really rallied, he dug in, he rode extremely well for 50 kilometres, even though he was, at times it looked like the gap was opening, but he held the gap. You know, he dug in when he clearly wasn't feeling too good, and you know, he rallied a lot on the final climb. But in the moment, they couldn't have known whether Kelderman was going to blow and lose 2 to 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 6 minutes.
Still a long way to go at that point.
A long way to go. And if Hindley had dropped back, and I you know, would they have got straight back on? Would Kelderman have stayed in once they got straight back on? All these things are unknowable. But what we do know is if Hindley had anchored himself to Kelderman, and they'd ridden in, and perhaps maybe limited Kelderman's losses by, what, maybe 30, 40 seconds, perhaps. All that would have done, really, would be to move Hindley further down the GC. It would marginally have strengthened Kelderman's position over Gegenhardt, but it would have put Hindley out of the picture. And from the team's point of view, with one mountain stage still to go, okay, it's not as severe with the Agnello not on the course on Saturday, but it's still three climbs of Sestriere. It's going to be hard. We could see the same sort of splits happening over those climbs. Far, far better to have Kelderman and Hindley number one and two, with only really Gegenhardt to worry about. Okay, Peo Bilbao has moved himself back into sort of distant contention, but the picture is pretty simple, and they're in a really good position, Sunweb, and it could have been an awful lot worse. And Francois, you're exactly right in what you say. Hindley could well have made more on that final climb, but had he tried to attack Gegenhardt, you know, it could have blown up in his face, and they could have been sat here tonight with Gegenhardt in the pink jersey, and then Kelderman and Luke Roberts and the whole Sunweb organisation really would have cause for grievance, and then they would have really messed it up. I think they played the percentages extremely well. The other point is that we were kind of talking about, Richard, this is your thing as well. If it hadn't been Hindley and Gegenhardt on the final climb, because Dennis would have been dropped and it would have been Gegenhardt on his own, suddenly Tao's race would have been completely transformed. Instead of riding side by side with Hindley up the final climb, both of them wondering what might happen, Gegenhardt in that similar position thinking, well, if I attack Hindley but don't drop him, I could be vulnerable to the counter-attack and my chance could slip. Gegenhardt's race would have been completely transformed. He would have been racing for the stage win and the pink jersey and trying to gain as much time as possible. And we might have seen him move out of touch of the two Sunweb riders. So I think, although Kelderman, we gather at the finish, not happy, with the fact that his teammate didn't wait. I think probably didn't help in the fact that the team car went past him as well on its way up to Hindley in the Valley Road. But I don't see what else they could have done. I mean, if they'd made an alternate decision, I think it would have worked out worse for them.
Yeah, I think if they'd got, you know, ordered Hindley to wait for Kelderman, it would have been a bigger gamble and it would have looked pretty daft. And I'm not even sure how much of a difference it would have made. You know, Kelderman was struggling and it was uphill, then downhill. There wasn't an awful lot of valley before the final climb. I mean, his head seemed to drop after the car went past him, but his body must have been pretty cold as well because he had problems with his jacket. We'll maybe get onto a little discussion on that because he and Jai Hindley had problems putting on their jackets for the descent, and they might pay for that over the next couple of days. Who knows? It might sort of slow down their recovery. I always believe as well that having a rider with those two riders up the road, it can slow them down, you know, because they've got someone sitting there who's not going to work. They're giving him a free ride. Psychologically, it's quite difficult then to make a really flat-out effort. That's not the case for Rohan Dennis, but for Teo Gegenhart, having this anchor sitting there, I think might have just taken up a percentage or two off his ability to commit fully to the ride. And as you say, Lionel, had he been on his own and riding to the stage win and the Giro and the pink jersey, he could have got it all out. Riding with Hindley sitting there is going to just weigh on his mind a little bit. But Kelderman is annoyed. You know, there's no question at all that he gave a couple of interviews at the finish where it was very clear that he wasn't happy that Hindley wasn't told to wait for him. And I think, you know, that the wider context of this is Kelderman's leaving the team. Hindley is not. Hindley's a young up-and-coming rider. They've now got two riders on the podium at the moment. But also, Kelderman is not one of your absolute bankers, you know, to win a Grand Tour. He never
did well in the third week of a Grand Tour.
You know, had it been Nibali or Froome or, you know, even Bernal or Carapaz or somebody who's proven themselves before and done it, you know, and if it was some, you know, Kelderman just doesn't convince in the same way as those guys do, or Roglic or somebody like that, Dumoulin. It might have been a different scenario, but the hierarchy in that team isn't and probably shouldn't be all about Wilco Kelderman. Not when Jai Hindley is clearly going as well as he's going.
We can wonder why Luke Roberts went to Hindley, you know, in the descent and left Kelderman there. What was it to? I mean, the official version is feeding.
Well, Hindley
was calling for the car.
Yeah, but
my impression was that the tactics were being decided at that very moment, and I think the reason why also neither Hindley or Gegenhart attacked on the final climb, they were both fearing the backlash. Like, you know, had Gegenhart attacked, Hindley would probably have countered it, gone for the stage win, and at the same time, as you said, Lionel, maybe Hindley was wary that, you know, Gegenhart might have countered and they would have lost everything. Still, if you see, you know, the showing of Hindley in the mountains in the last couple of mountain stages, I can't see how it'll be a tricky one in Sestriere in 2 days' time, you know, because I can't see. But at the finish, as you say, Kelderman looked pissed off, but he looked really, really tired as well. And I can't see him recover and be a major contender in Sestriere in 2 days' time. But I can really see Hindley being again, you know, in a position to either win the stage or, you know, make up some time. So what do they do in Sestriere? All for Kelderman, or I mean, there's still headaches ahead of for Sunweb.
I mean, a word on Teo Gegenhart. We're talking a lot here about the Sunweb riders, but I listened to Teo Gegenhart's interview after the stage, and what's clear is that, you know, he did not expect to find himself in this position. He sounds slightly bemused that he is in this position, and not speaking like somebody who really feels that it's on, and yet it is on. You know, he's third on GC, he's 15 seconds down, And it's fascinating to look back at the first few stages of this race. The stage one time trial in Palermo, Hindley was actually the quickest of the three of those riders there, with Kelderman 13 seconds behind him, Theo Gegenhardt 36 seconds behind Hindley there. In the stage 14 time trial, Kelderman was the quickest with Hart 37 seconds down on him, Hindley 1:52 down in that time trial. But also if we look at Mount Etna, Kelderman was the best up there. Hindley lost 58 seconds that day, and Theo Gegenhardt lost 1:53 on Etna to Kelderman. I mean, the margins now are so small, and yet those kind of time differences in those three stages are pretty significant, pretty substantial.
That's why I'm saying the TT was probably what was at the back of Luke Roberts' mind and the Sunweb team's mind. You know, they tried to limit his losses today. I think in the finale of today's stage, because normally on you can win the Giro on the TT. That was the main thing.
Well, the atmosphere. Sorry, Francois. I was going to say
the atmosphere
at the Sunweb dinner table tonight might be as chilly as that descent of the Stelvio. Because that was the other big talking point. Their inability, the Ineos riders, you know, Theo Gegenhardt and Rowan Dennis, 1 minute they were riding up there in their racing jerseys, the next minute they seemed to have their winter jackets on. I don't know how they did it or when they did it, whether they had drones maybe dropping them down onto them. You know, Team Ineos have thought of everything, haven't they? But
I think it was like Mr. Ben. They just went into a shop and then they came out in the right outfit.
Yeah.
Well, from what I heard, we should check that. But they were not even the same jackets because Hindley was wearing a special jacket with the white jersey on that had been given to him by the organizers. So you know, Kelderman's and Hindley's jackets were not the same brand. So you know, maybe it's part of the marginal gains, and Ineos Grenadiers have a training session in the you know, change your you know, put on your jacket course or something.
But these skills can be the difference between winning and losing a race. Most famously in 1998 when Jan Ullrich had a problem putting on his jacket and really suffered with the cold and probably lost the Tour de France that day. I remember speaking to Bobby Julich about it, and he was having similar problems on that descent and eventually stopped and did manage to put...
That's the way to do it.
Yeah, I mean,
some guys... Yeah,
he was really glad he'd done that.
Yeah, I was listening to Eurosport France I mean, the guys there, they were former riders. They were saying to Hindley and then not Kelderman to Hindley, but stop, you know, you'll make it back easily, you know, stop, put on your jacket and join the guys, you know, and well, there you are.
Certainly think that that would have been a smart play. I mean, when you think that we saw recently in the Tour de France, you know, all the kind of effort and thought and just calm-headedness about swapping from a time trial bike to a road bike on the Planche des Belles-Filles time trial, you know, the time lost is factored in. What is it, you know, is it going to be 15 seconds, 30 seconds, whatever, but they make the calculation that it will pay back on the climb by being on a different bike. And of course they're getting started again on not necessarily on you know, the fastest bit of road. Going over the top of the Stelvio, you could afford to put a foot down, just take a breath, get the jacket on. I mean, this is so easy for us to think from our comfy armchairs watching the Giro. But I was kind of crying out, you know, it was a kilometre or so for Hindley to put on that jacket.
A lot of nervous energy used.
Exactly,
stress.
Just the stress of doing it. He nearly came a crop at one point.
And the stress for all
of
us watching.
yeah.
I mean, my blood pressure was through the roof.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, end of the granddads. In the old days, they would have put you know, the newspaper pages on there.
Well, you know, on there. These days
you can't put a laptop. You can't put a laptop in your on your body.
Fulsang and Nibali stopped, put their pipe and slippers for them at the summit. But as it happens, as I watched them both, the two Sunweb riders, struggle with their jackets, a conversation came into my head that I had recently with one of their sports directors, Hans Timmermans, who looks after mainly the women's team. But I was asking him quite a lot about what Sunweb had done in lockdown, and he emphasised that they'd really worked a lot on technical skills, as he called them. Well, here's what he said.
What we did also, that they need to put out their leg warmers within 5 meters. So one on, one off. And I think in that part, we already make big steps into the technical part of cycling, which is also a really important part.
So Timmermans there saying that one of the activities they'd worked on was taking off leg warmers in races and in certain periods of time. But I don't know if they practiced with their rain jackets as well. They should have done. However, the circumstances today were very particular, and the weather and the cold and all the rest of it. And well, we thought we'd ask one of our audio diarists for an insight into, you know, just how difficult it was to put jackets on and whether it is something that professional riders do practice. Here is Joe Dombrowski.
It's funny you ask about the rain jackets. I actually had a musette with a GABA and gloves inside a K from the top of the Stelvio, and I couldn't put it on either. I tried and then, you know, almost crashed, and it was a bit embarrassing actually. And I mean, normally that sort of thing isn't a problem, but to be honest, I think that, you know, you mentioned Wilco had a hard time putting his jacket on and eventually just kind of dropped it at some point anyway. I think that the fatigue comes into it. I really think that, like, probably most of the guys are so fatigued on a day like today that basic motor skills start to kind of deteriorate. I mean, think about it this way. If you did a 400-meter all-out sprint on the track, and then within 5 seconds after, it's like, okay, tie your shoes. It sounds simple, but actually, if you do it, I think it's a little bit harder than you would think. So I think on a day like today, where it's really full on racing and there's a lot of fatigue, and I don't know why, but the last week in this Giro, we've had really long stages. I think since the second rest day, every day has been over 6 hours on the bike. And then again, tomorrow is, something crazy, like 250 Ks. So I think probably, you know, something like that, that like taking off knee warmers, putting on gloves, putting on a rain jacket when you're fresh, those sorts of things are easy. But, it's funny you asked, because I had the same situation today. I couldn't put my GAB on. And I mean, at that point, the GC group had caught us and I was just kind of riding to the finish. So I stopped on the side of the road, put the jacket on, put my gloves on and took my time. But I actually experienced the same thing.
Well, we know, Rich, that when Rod Ellingworth ran the British Cycling Academy based out in Italy, these were all the skills that he would work on with the young riders, because he was training them to become professionals. And part of a lot of the work of professional riders is not just trying to win races, it's the bread and butter, isn't it? Dropping back to the car, carrying bottles, having a conversation with a sports director while the car's moving along at 45 kilometers an hour, picking a bottle from the soigneur on the side of the road, taking stuff out of a musette after the feed zone, passing a musette to a teammate. All of these kind of skills are part of the rider's armory, and if you can be just good at them and do them automatically in times of stress when it's extremely cold, and as Joe Dombrowski says there, the fine touch of your fingertips has gone in the cold, and the heart's beating, it can stand riders in good stead. But
it's like penalty shootouts. Easy to say. I think it's like penalty shootouts. Footballers, you know, any professional footballer can take a penalty. And you know, they practice them all the time. But when it comes to the situation where you've got, you know, a lot at stake and a crowd watching, it just makes it harder. And here also you've got the weather playing a factor, and the motor skills go as Joe said.
But
yeah.
I was just
about to say, you know, I'm going to keep an eye on eBay tonight, because I'm sure there's a couple of white rain jackets on sale, so for cheap. So have a look.
I'm not sure we would get into those jackets. I think we'd have a similar problem getting into them, but for different reasons.
I might get into it, but there's no way I'd get the zip up.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport, our long-time supporter since the Giro in 2016. Bet they never thought they'd be supporting us at the Giro in October 2020, but here we are. If you want 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. SISCP25. If you're getting on your turbo trainer as the nights are drawing in, do have a look at their Turbo Plus range with the menthol flavours. Help you cool down when it gets too hot. Scienceandsport.com, SISCP25. Earlier this week, we also announced that we have a new relationship or a new partnership with LACA, the bike insurance company. They are a cooperative, LACA, so it's a sort of collective arrangement whereby your premiums are capped and they are dependent on others' claims. A lot of customers, myself included, have found it a pretty cost-effective way of insuring your bike. And we've got a relationship with LACA whereby you can join a cycling podcast club at LACA. If you sign up at laca.co.uk and enter the code TCP, you will become part of the cycling podcast community within LACA. And there'll be various perks and benefits to that, which we will reveal in due course. Lionel, you look like you're going to say something.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, if you're, I know there's not much bike racing going on at the moment, but they will cover your bikes for incidents. If you damage your bike in a crash in a race, for example, that can be covered, and cover you when you go off on a training camp. LACA is a community of cyclists. They understand cyclists. They know what equipment and bikes they are covering. So, there's no confusion. If you have to come and make a claim, they're not going to suddenly, you know, say, but your bike's the same value as a small family car. I don't understand. They understand what they're covering.
I should also have said that if you become a member of the cycling podcast community within LACA, you benefit the podcast. So it's another way of supporting the podcast. So thanks very much, everyone who has signed up. Any more talking points from the Giro today before we hear from another of our diarists, James Knox?
Yes.
Yes, Francois.
Yes. Now, I wanted to make a point about, Team Ineos. I've never been much of a supporter or a fan of Team Sky or Team Ineos. But the depth of their, you know, of their team is we know that. It's been amazing. I mean, we saw, obviously, the stage wins they had in the Giro. Losing their leader on the first day was impressive already. But what Rohan Dennis did today, we knew is much more than just a time trial specialist. I mean, came second in the Tour de Suisse 2 years ago behind Egan Bernal. So, I mean, he's a guy who's more of a versatile rider than we think. But we sometimes think. But what he did today was absolutely amazing. And once again, the depth of the team, on all terrains, even in the Vuelta, when you think that the three leading men for the past 10 years, I mean, Froome, Thomas, Bernal, are nowhere to be seen. They still have, the means, the strengths, the crew to keep, you know, challenging and they'll be obviously in contention to win this Giro. I still believe, you know, still putting my money on the same guy. And I think that the way, you know, Dennis rode, the way he sacrificed himself, you know, he knows he's not the fastest guy in the team or in the world anymore in time trials. Dennis's perception we have of Dennis is, you know, twofold, because he's a strange man. He's got a strong temper and kind of very odd character, but what he did today, well, chapeau.
Absolutely. I feel we also ought to redress the balance a little bit, Rich, with Jakob Fuglsang, because he's climbed up six places today. He looked very good, certainly compared to how he had looked on the earlier uphill finishes, but perhaps this, you know, played to his strength, a real tough stage late in the race, but up to sixth place overall. And the King of the Mountains competition also has a lot more clarity today. There'd been this battle between Ruben Guerrero of EF Pro Cycling and Giovanni Visconti. Visconti was a non-starter today, according to his team. He had been struggling a bit with pain in his right knee, and he didn't start the stage today. Guerrero scored a lot more points on the climbs today, so he is now enjoying a commanding lead of over 112 point lead, I think it is, over Thomas de Gent. So looks like Guerrero, who won a stage early on in the Giro, of course, will also take the blue jersey.
Well, do any of you out there fancy becoming a professional cyclist? Do you dream of the kind of glamour of professional cycling and think it would be the job for you, the life for you? Well, listen to James Knox's diary from today. One of our diarists rides for De Koenig Quickstep. It was their final day defending the pink jersey held by Joao Almeida. Here's James Knox.
Oh, wow. 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 I don't know what to say. What a day. Disgusting in many, many ways. And obviously, shit day for us in the end. Not really any way to put around it. We did a good job up until Stelvio, but then somebody started riding hard. I got dropped, and then I think sounds like Rowan Dennis just took over and blew everyone off the wheel, Joao included. Fausto did what he could to try and help him and limit losses, which sounds like they did a remarkable job in limiting losses and staying that fifth place in GC, which, yeah, is a move down, but it's also still a great ride considering everything. It was unbelievable rides today by Jai and Teo. Mind-blowing. Those guys are just tearing it apart. From my perspective, did what I could today. Tried to stay active and in the front at the start and make sure there was no disaster breakaways going. Obviously spent a bit of legs. But yeah, that's not to make any excuses. I was way off the pace when we started going up the Stelvio and got dispatched well and good and proper. With a long, long way to go, it's pretty disheartening when you're already on the limit with 20k of 2,000 metres of vertical ascent or whatever it is to go. And then from there, yeah, just felt worse and worse and worse, just hating life, to be honest. Seri caught up to me, took care of me, shouted at him, begged him, pleaded, please go slower. And yeah, eventually he slowed down to such a pace that we were crawling over the top. We had a little group, which was a nice little group and turned into absolute shambles in the last K when everyone started panicking, stopping, putting on jackets. We should have just had a mutual agreement, we all just up on the top. But yeah, there was then suddenly bodies everywhere on the descent and I think a few lads didn't get back on, but I was okay. Got my Musette and a nice hot energy mix, a bottle of water that I could just, nice bit of hot fluid, got all my kit on and descended down the Stelvio, so wasn't too cold. I had a load of gear on. And then the final climb to Cancano, just ticking down the hairpins again. Not quite as miserable as ticking down all the 55 or how many of the hairpins there are on the Stelvio, but still ticking them down and then stuck in a traffic jam to the hotel. Yeah, just on the massage table now and yeah, soaking in the day, to be honest. What day it was. 7 hours I was on the bike. Stuffed my face with a big packet of crisps and three toasted sandwiches because I couldn't face another bowl of pasta. Yeah, it's got to that now. Survival, innit? Madness now, just madness. There's 10 guys left with legs by the looks of it, and everyone else is battling on. Rode down the final climb with all the punters who'd ridden up and clapped in the gruppetto, and wow, you've got to you've got to take your hat off to them. Cheering on Alvaro, survived another day. I know we've got safety in numbers, but I think some of those boys were out the arse from the first 2-3 kilometers today, and that was their whole race. Can you imagine? 210 kilometers, chopping off behind the race, last ambulance and broom wagon following you. Yeah. So I shouldn't complain. It could always be worse. But those lads soldiered on, got through another day. 260 kilometers and rain to look forward to tomorrow. I honestly can't get my head around it. What's that all about? So grim. 260k, raining all day, pan flat roads. I'm just going to wear all my kit. I'm going to get all the hot cream on myself. Just sit last wheel. Count down the Ks. It's just, what's that all about? Stage 19. Yeah, no one needs that, do they? But what can you do? What can you do? Yeah. Really surprised how hard this is. Don't know if I've been spending pennies when I haven't had them. All the emotional and whatever of defending pink jersey and all this, but yeah. I'm done now. Wow. So, keep my head down for the next couple of days, see what happens, but just dreaming of Milan now. Big time. Big time.
Well, I mean, that's a bit of a mood killer, isn't
really
it?
Really sells it, I mean, doesn't it?
You know, people do occasionally make comments about the advertising in the cycling podcast. I mean, that's a from the horse's
bit
mouth.
Negative, a bit of negative advertising there for
you've got to sell. You've got to sell it, James. I mean, I do sympathise. Listen, with him, though. 258 kilometres, I think it is, tomorrow. It's more or less flat. As he says, the weather forecast is not great. I know the Grand Tours are often, you know, hostages to the start and finishes in towns that are available to host the race, but it does seem unusually cruel to have basically a classic length stage in between these two mountain stages. And it's that change of rhythm we've often talked about. It could be an extremely slow, long day in the saddle, and the climbers will have to get their climbing legs back again right off the start line on Saturday. So it's a real rhythm breaker
here
tomorrow.
Here's my prediction, though. I think James Knox will be up the road in the break on Saturday. That's what happens. You mark my words. Well, okay, we're going to move on to the Vuelta in a moment, but who's going to win the Giro first? Lionel, who is going to win the Giro?
I hate doing this, but I think Theo Gegenhardt might win it.
Francois, you think Theo Gegenhardt as well?
Yeah, well, I didn't name the guy, but I said Ineos Grenadier. So yeah, I think he will win it. I think he. I don't know. That's the feeling I have. His form has been improving since the start of Giro, and this is, you know, this is what you know, Grand Tour winners do. Kelderman is fading. Inley is probably not good enough in time trials. And for me, I mean, yeah, the up and coming force is Gegenhardt.
I mean, I it's not impossible. I thought Kelderman was pretty impressive today to sort of crack a bit and come back from that. I thought was really impressive. He did sort of fade a little bit again towards the finish, but on the climb, he really did rally pretty well. And that was after being passed by Fuglsang and Bilbao, who rode very well as well today. We should have said he was third on the stage. So finishes. Kelderman, if Kelderman recovers, okay, I think he could still, you know, with the stage that we've got on Saturday. If it was the Agnello, I would be more pessimistic about his chances. But I think he's still sort of in the driving seat. I mean, we should say as well, Stelvio. Absolutely magnificent. It looked amazing. It was a beautiful stage to watch, and it really delivered today's stage.
I think you've got to go with Theo Gegenhardt because the race finishes with a 10-mile time trial. I mean, that's bread and butter for anyone brought up with cycling in the UK. But also, well, we had Joao in the pink jersey. Then it could be Jai or it could be Theo. Jai, Theo, it's an amalgamation of Joao, isn't it? Put them together.
And once again,
I mean, the guys who did the race today, the guys who really made the Stelvio today were the Ineos Grenadier, were Dennis and Gegenhardt. They're the one who really, you know, blew up the bunch and ruined Almeida's chances.
All right, Mr. Ineos fanboy.
So they probably do the same again in Sicily. I think he's got the best chances.
Francois, I'm sure the coast for lunch with Jim Ratcliffe tomorrow. Down in Monaco.
How did you know that?
Oh, brilliant!
with my sunwebbed rain jacket. And,
well, listen. Yeah. let's get on to the Vuelta before we run into overtime as we did last night as well, and we probably will do tonight. But today felt like, you know, a stage that really worth kind of digging into in some detail. Dan Martin, he hasn't won a race in a long, long time. Very emotional in his post-race interview. He said it was his first win since becoming a father, having twin girls. Almost exactly the same day as you became a father, Lionel, and you've not had a win since then either. So something you've got in common.
Objection there. I mean, in downhill, remember downhill cycling. You know?
How can we forget? Well, Dan Martin, very good at uphill cycling and went pretty early, I thought. I mean, once again, Sepp Kuss looked just like he was on rails, very smooth, and looked like he could, you know, float away at any point, like a butterfly. But he's always kind of looking back, isn't he? It's a bit like Andy Schleck and Frank Schleck when they rode together. Andy was always looking over his shoulder for Frank, and Sepp Kuss is a bit like that with Primoz Roglic at the moment. I mean, Roglic looks strong, but yeah, great win for Dan Martin and for his team, Israel Startup Nation. And Chris Froome is joining that team next year. Also looked a bit better today.
Yeah, had a little flurry on the front, didn't he? Kind of didn't recognise him out of the saddle and on the front. I don't know why. Yeah. His style didn't look quite the same.
Yeah, the head keeps moving up and down, and yeah, you could tell he was Froome. Not as
looked pretty similar to me, I must admit.
Yeah, he was a mile. I think. How long did he last? A mile, maybe a mile and a half.
A mile.
No.
Mile.
I said lots of good things about Ineos, so I mean no, but you're right. It was nice to see him do the job and do his best, and as you know, we were mentioning the granddads. I mean the Nibelis, there were far worse off granddads than Chris Froome. I'm thinking of Dumoulin and of course of Thibaut Pinot. I don't know if Thibaut Pinot is a granddad, not yet, but anyway, it's nice to see Froome, yeah. You know, doing his job, he'll go all the way probably in this Vuelta, I hope, which won't be the case for some other guys.
Somebody didn't have such a good day, Esteban Chavez, who's been riding really well, and it's been nice to see him be really up there at the sharp end the last couple of days, but he had a puncture today, a really terrible moment, and he lost four places, so he slipped to eighth. Lost a minute or so today, Esteban Chavez. Not disastrous, but not ideal. And, the guy who helped him try to get back on was Nick Schultz, who's keeping an audio diary for us at the Vuelta. So we asked Nick for a little update tonight, and here's what Nick had to say.
Stage three. As you would have seen if you watched the stage, we had quite a bit of bad luck with Esteban on the final climb. He had a mechanical problem and had to first of all get onto Skabu's bike, which was way too big for him. So he was riding out of the saddle for a little bit and then had another bike change and got back onto one of his spares. At that point of the race, I was waiting for him and helping pace him back onto the bunch the first time, and then the second time just pacing for as long as I could before he sort of took over and did a time trial to the line. But he limited the losses quite well, considering. It was just really, really bad timing and really bad luck. But we certainly haven't lost any morale from it, and we'll keep fighting day by day and take every opportunity we can. So, yeah, I mean, the goal for the team is still, you know, to look out for Esteban and Mikel and see what we can do there. And while looking for stage opportunities with basically anyone in the team, we've got a strong opportunistic team here. And we'll be looking to go after any stages that present themselves and just be opportunistic and smart about the stages that we want to go for. We'll see what happens in the coming days. Tomorrow could be a very fast day with a little bit of cross tailwind. So yeah, I think gear selection might be important. Might need to pull out the 55 tooth chainring tomorrow. Could be a very fast one.
Well, Esteban Chavez did limit his losses to 1:06, and he's down to 8th overall, 1:29 behind Roglic. The same cast of characters at the top of the GC, isn't it, Rich? It's Roglic and Carapaz, but now with Dan Martin in the, what's that, Slovenian-Ecuadorian sandwich. Doesn't really work.
Doesn't really work. Well, Poles rode well today. He looked off the pace earlier, but fourth on the stage today. Pretty good ride from him. And Alexander Vlasov as well looked pretty good today. Mm. So one or two new characters coming to the mix. But yeah, we've had three pretty similar kind of stages with similar outcomes, really, haven't we?
Mm. It's been when you have 1, 2, 3 with the three jerseys and the top three guys in the GC being top three guys in the stage. I mean, that's been the Vuelta so far. Like it's already, you know, all set. I hope it's not. But a quick word on, maybe not so quick, on Dan Martin. Dan Martin could be an example for the granddads. He's way past his 30s. He had two difficult years, lots of injuries. Crashed in the Dauphiné this year, you know, injured his back. And here he is, you know, you could tell from day one that he is in great shape. I think, and well, you could tell in the interview, you know, as you know, he was really emotional about it. I think I heard he hadn't won a race for 834 days. I don't know if it's right, but you can check that.
Yeah, I saw that as well. Amazing.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, it's great because I think we all like Dan Martin. He's you know, a great rider and lots of registry. I mean, he can, you know, we remember his wins in Liège, Bastogne-Liège, Tour of Lombardy, and a couple of Vuelta stages. And it's great to see him back in there, you know, where he belongs.
Yeah, that last victory you're talking about was on the Mur de Bretagne in the Tour de France in 2018. Yeah, Richard, you commented about him going from a long way out. I thought it was far too far out. I mean, you know, shows how much I know. But, I mean, it was, a real indication of confidence in his own strength, I think. I mean, he was racing against Carapaz and Roglic, who are also good on that kind of finish. So, bodes well for Dan Martin. And, we were talking last night, weren't we, about the fact that the Tourmalet stage on Sunday might be hanging in the balance. That is now significantly rerouted, isn't it? They're not going into France and they won't be going up the Tourmalet on Sunday.
That's right. Similar problem, I think, as in with the Giro and Saturday's stage, they've rerouted Saturday's stage of the Vuelta as well, haven't they?
Sundays, but yeah, they're going to Formigal, which is where Quintana and Contador ambushed Chris Froome with that incredible, basically it was a real heist, wasn't it? They got away and consigned Froome and co to a long chase and put him out of the picture. It was an extraordinary stage and a tough finish, a tough climb, but not quite the Tourmalet. But at least there's a stage on Sunday, and it will suit the same sorts of riders. It won't alter the race all that much, I don't think.
Well, listen, chaps, we should wrap things up. We'll be back again tomorrow, of course, with more from the Giro and the Vuelta. Before we go, we'd like to say some thank yous to friends of the podcast. Thanks very much, everybody who's signed up at thecyclingpodcast.com. From me, a big thank you to Alistair Lum, P.A. Jones, Keith Brigham. Is that Keith Brigham or Keith Brigham? John Hope, David Morgan, Jacob Nielsen, and Ewan Monroe.
And a big thank you to Matt Higton, David A. Clark, Craig Starling, Rory Comber, Gemma Asker, Jackie Foster, and Philip Chapman.
And great thanks to William Carter, Jason Penny, Richard Wood, Thomas Anderson, Michael Chan, Mark Stafford, and Philip Kelly.
And thank you to you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And to you, Francois.
Thank you very much.
We'll have Francois back in a few stages' time. Tomorrow we'll be joined by double Giro Rosa stage winner Lizzie Banks.